It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Mark Simon. Mark Simon is an attorney and filmmaker. He is a graduate of the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law and is an alumnus of its Innocence Project, and which is an experience which inspired him to become the co-writer and co-producer of the new film After Innocence, which is now playing in Seattle. Mark, thank you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin, and maybe you can tell us how you initially got involved with the Innocence Project.
Sure. I was a student, as you said, at Cardozo Law School in New York, and it has the Innocence Project, which was founded by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld to exonerate the wrongfully convicted with the use of DNA evidence. Science technology, which can prove conclusively whether there might be, whether there is an individual in prison who is actually factually guilty for which a crime he's been in prison for years and years and years. And I did go to Cardozo in large part because of the Innocence Project. I didn't know that one day I'd make a movie that resulted from that experience, but I just had a natural proclivity to this issue and to this, you know, justice. It's the ultimate nightmare. You know, being in prison for something that you didn't do for decades. And something pulled me there. It was a fantastic experience. And I met many exonerees, one in particular, Herman Atkins, who was in the film After Innocence. And I had an opportunity to speak with him. And I realized that exoneration was really only half the story, and that society wasn't paying attention to the fact that once the exonerated are released, no one's there to help them transition back into society. The factually guilty have benefits from systems such as parole. Parole might not be perfect, but it allows them a hand to help them transition in terms of job training, housing. Well, the exonerees who were innocent were getting out without even an apology. So I wanted to do something about that, and years later, this is the result after Innocence, and it won the Sundance Film Festival in 2005 and multiple other film festivals, and it's going around the country right now, and it opened in Seattle this weekend.
And what was the spark that got you to think, oh, maybe we should produce a film about this?
I did have some background in the film industry, not documentaries per se, but I was always drawn to documentaries. Even as a child, I used to watch them on TV and just thought they were powerful, you know, truth and the real person. In the case of After Innocence, to do justice to these individual stories, I realized it had to be something big. It wasn't a book. I wanted the public to see this horrific tale, but it's also a heroic tale because these guys are the ultimate heroes. They don't quit. They keep pushing. So it wasn't an actor. It was these people. No one can do justice to their story like they can. And that is why it became a documentary. And it was always a documentary from the beginning. I would say my third year in law school, which was the year after I did the Innocence Project, is when I had the idea to make this documentary. I remember I walked into the executive director's office of the Innocence Project at the time and said that I wanted to do this film when I graduated about life after exoneration. And the next year, I started out as a lawyer in New York City and at the same time started planning the film.
So how did you go about selecting those that would be the focus of your film?
It started out with a strategic plan to have the exonerees in the film represent the community as a whole nationally in terms of race, in terms of geography, in terms of the length of incarceration. What were they incarcerated for? How long have they been out? What was the cause of the wrongful conviction? Was it misidentification or was it prosecutorial misconduct? That was the basis, the foundation for picking the exonerees in the film. But then certain stories just resonated with us. Our first initial shoot was at the first ever Life After Exoneration program gathering of exonerees, and there were over 30 exonerees who attended this conference. And as a result of meeting individuals like Scott Hornoff, who is a wrongfully convicted police officer from Rhode Island, a white middle-class police officer with a really strong spirit, well, that was someone who we really felt needed to be in this film, because if it can happen to him, it truly can happen to anyone. So that was how the, for lack of a better word, the casting came about, and these guys became the core of After Innocence.
So maybe tell us a couple of the stories, if you could, of those people that you focus on.
Sure. And there's one individual who, unlike all the other exonerees in the film, are on the outside. There's one story which keeps the dramatic thread of the film together, and that's an individual by the name of Wilton Dedge. And Wilton, when you meet him in the film, has been in prison for 22 years, and he's in prison, and he's trying to get out. And there's been a DNA test of hair that proves scientifically that he was not at the scene of the crime. Without getting into details, the prosecutors who used that hair to convict him 22 years ago now are saying it did not matter, that that hair was not his. They fought to prevent a retrial, and when you meet him in the film, 3 years ago, we knew that hair didn't belong to him. And his story and his attorney's fight provides the dramatic backbone for the film. And I will tell you that today in Seattle there'll be a few special speakers following Q&As. I know for sure after the 7 p.m. showing at the Varsity Theater, and possibly after the 4 o'clock, but definitely after the 7 o'clock, there will be a special exoneree there. I'm not going to say who it is, but I might have perked some interest. And some other exonerees in the film... there's Vincent Modo from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. He lived, it's ironic, the year I graduated from college at Penn was the year that he was exonerated after spending over a decade in prison for a crime he didn't commit. To this day, his record hasn't been expunged, so his record still shows his criminal conviction. He hasn't been compensated, and he's fighting to change the law. All of these guys are really activists. And they're pushing for change. Also, the only state that has two people, two exonerees in the film is Pennsylvania. The other is Nick Yaris. And Nick Yaris spent 23 years on death row in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania. And he is a tour de force, his spirit in the film. I mean, this guy is one strong individual to be able to have come through what he went through. And Nick... is his story's profiled in the film. Herman Atkins, who, as I mentioned, was the inspiration for the film from Los Angeles, he is in the film. He's very interesting in that he graduated college after he was exonerated, and he's pushing for an education to go back and then help other exonerees. And then finally, there's Dennis Maher. He's from Massachusetts. He's the only exoneree who in the film... which the film chronicles, did receive compensation. He's from the state of Massachusetts. They're one of the leaders in the country in terms of compensation legislation. It's certainly not enough. Dennis spent 19 years in prison, and the maximum that you can recover under the law is $500,000. But that's far better than the majority of states in this country. Washington right here is one of the states that has no compensation statute. So those are really the key players. There's another story with Ronald Cotton and Jennifer Thompson, which really resonates with the audiences. Jennifer was a victim of rape who misidentified Ronald as her attacker. Years later, DNA proved that Ronald was not, in fact, the rapist, but they have now formed a bond, and they speak out across the country about the problems of eyewitness identification. And in the movie, you see them come together, and that's also a special moment.
So, what has been, since you've been traveling with the film, what has been people's reactions to the film so far?
I mean, people are really blown away. It's truly, I mean, obviously I'm the producer, I have a vested interest in this, but the truth is that people who see this movie, they're blown away by the content, but they're also blown away by the film. It's a very dramatic film. It has a dramatic arc, just as any feature film would. But it's a movie that, you know, as someone said last night to me, there's so many movies that are made, and only a handful of those films really make a difference. She said, your film does that in spades. I would say one of the most special things, we were in Boston last week, and three exonerees were there. Dennis was there from Massachusetts, Scott from Rhode Island, and Vincent from Philly. And that even shows you, I mean, Vincent came up to support his brothers. You know, he came up to support the other guys in the film. And after seeing the film, I mean, I watched two women just come up in tears to hug these guys and just say, you know, thank you for being here. This meant so much to me. I'm going to go out and I really want to get involved. The audiences are really just overwhelmed. People don't realize that, you know, innocent people are in prison. People don't realize how prevalent it is. People don't realize how easy it can happen. And they're really, really shocked to see. People assume that once the innocent are freed, that their lives are going to be easier. That, well, obviously they're getting help. They're getting millions of dollars. You know, but the fact is, no, that's not the case. It's the complete opposite. They don't get an apology. They don't get money. They don't have job training. They don't have housing assistance. They literally go back into the world without anything. And unlike the factually guilty who know that they've served their time for a purpose, you know, to pay the penalty, the innocent, it's, you know, this double-edged, ironic tragedy. They were really wrong twice. You know, they were wronged by their wrongful conviction, and then they get out, and there's no one to help them back on their feet. We're trying to change that. The Life After Exoneration program, which I alluded to before, its website is exonerated.org, and it's a organization. It's the only national organization that's trying to help these guys, but it's a startup. It's like a mom-and-pop organization that is trying to get funded, is trying to get there. So it needs help. It needs help in terms of financial backing. It needs help in terms of volunteers. And hopefully, you know, with this film pushing the issue, it will get there. And also I should say that the film's website is afterinnocence.com. We'll repeat that. But if you go to the film's website, it provides information on where the film is playing nationally. It gives every theater that it's gone to and will go to, and we update that. And it also gives the organizations that are involved in the movie, such as the Innocence Project, the Life After Exoneration Program, and it tells you how to get involved. One of the things we do at the theater, there's a brochure, 5 things that you can do to get involved in this issue. And so those brochures are at the Varsity Theater. And, you know, we're pushing.
We're talking with Mark Simon. He is producer and writer of the new documentary, After Innocence. It would seem as well, among the long list of things that have been taken away from these people, you know, including like the massive amounts of time they serve, that whatever they had prior to that, you know, jobs and a life and, you know, like this whole infrastructure that we have around us that a lot of us, I think, take for granted, they can't really go back to. I mean, it's just been wiped clean in a lot of instances.
Yeah, no, that's right. The only individual I know who has really gone back, well, no, his life's different too. It's Dennis from Massachusetts. When he was exonerated, he had a plan. He had been in the Army. And that's the other myth that these guys, you know, some people think, well, if they didn't do this, they must have done something else. These must have been bad people. How can you, you know, be innocent in prison? You must have done something. No. The guys that are in this film, you know, these are not guys who had committed crimes before. You know, the vast majority of exonerees in the country, you know, they were not criminals. They were innocent people who something bad happened to. Is there an exception to that rule? Of course. But for the vast majority, that's the case. So Dennis had been in the Army. He had been a mechanic also. And when he was exonerated, he had a plan. He was going to go out. He was going to get a job as a mechanic. He was going to get married. He was going to have kids. He was going to start his life. And amazingly, Dennis has really followed suit. And he's the only one. Within 2 months of being exonerated, he got a job as a preventive maintenance mechanic for a garbage company. What's that major garbage company? I'm blanking on the name.
Waste Management.
There we go, Waste Management. And that's in the film. And just to even show you what Dennis is made of, after 19 years in prison for something that he didn't do, he gets out, gets a job 2 months after, and it's the night shift. He's working the middle of the night. I think his hours start at 8 p.m., and he goes till 6 in the morning, something like that, gets out. Never a complaint. He earned an extra dollar an hour because it was the night shift. That made him happy. And this is profiled in the movie also. He's on the websites, Match.com, Yahoo Personals, you know, trying to find a mate, and he talks about how it's so difficult. You know, he says that, you know, women get scared once he explains his situation. And I don't want to give too much away, but the bottom line is he's gotten his job, he's met a woman, and the movie shows that he's, you know, pushing to fatherhood, and he's actually now had two kids. He had a second child this past week. So he's an amazing guy, but they can't just go back. I mean, imagine tomorrow if you were just plucked off the street and put in prison for 10 years. You cannot just go back and restart your life. It's not that seamless, and not one of these guys, not even Dennis, who had been in the Army, you know, just went back to the lives they had. And the emotional and psychological damage is immense, and they struggle with it on a daily basis.
What was the situation with their families and or friends? Did they get abandoned by them? Did their friends and families stick together with them?
What's interesting to me, and the exonerees who I know, and the exonerees who were in the film, these are the success stories. These are the exonerees that were able to make it and function. And the common denominator to why is because they have strong families. It's because they had strong friends who supported them. Those that don't have that, it's far, far more difficult. I do know of a few exonerees that came out and they didn't have anyone there. And it's very difficult for them. The other thing that occurs to me about those individuals with no friends or family on the outside, those might be the ones that we never know. Those are the ones who die in prison. Those are the ones who didn't fight. Those are the ones who were not able to keep hope and keep fighting. The common denominator between the exonerees who make it on the outside, they have strong families. They have strong friendly bonds, strong friend bonds to help them. There's 170 DNA exonerees out there. DNA is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, DNA is only available in that small select group of cases where there's blood evidence, where there's semen evidence, skin evidence, but the vast majority of crimes don't have that. I think the statistic is less than 20% of crimes involve biological evidence. So it's a reality that if we take that and put that up against another statistic, which is that there's 2.2 million people approximately in the prisons and jails in the federal and state system, a 1% error rate would be a 1% error rate would be over 20,000 people in prison who are wrongfully convicted. And based on some other studies that are done, that have been done, there's hard reason to believe that the number is far greater. So of those who make it eventually out and have their innocence acknowledged, it's not everyone, and you know, that's just a sad truth.
And what's your sense from the people you've worked with for how many of these cases were pushed through by prosecutors that must have known that the people were innocent?
That question's asked a lot. That's a hard question. I would like to believe and do believe that cases where the prosecutors actually believe that someone's innocent that they're prosecuting, but they're pushing forward to just get someone off the street or for political reasons, I think that is the very, very small minority. I think most prosecutors, you know, want to do their job. That doesn't mean that there's not prosecutorial misconduct in other ways that leads to the conviction of the wrongful, that leads to the conviction of the innocent. For example, the prosecutor might believe that Wilton Dedge is guilty, but he gets snitch testimony to back up his conviction or his hope for a conviction. Prosecutors might tell that snitch or another witness important information about the crime that allows that individual to get on the stand and give evidence that to a jury is overwhelming. So prosecutors do cross the line in ways that can lead to the prosecution of innocent people. But I do think it's only a very small case where they maliciously do so to get someone off the street who they have a really good basis to believe that they're innocent. So that would be my answer to that.
So what's your sense then for why the system puts in innocent people like this? I mean, was there a common theme there, or was it a wide range of reasons?
Yeah, I mean, also there's a book that Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld wrote called Actual Innocence, which gets into some of the reasons that lead to wrongful conviction. Also, there's a book right now out by Lola Volin, who's the founder of the Life After Exoneration Program, out about it, and for some reason I'm blanking on the name of the book. I apologize, Lola. But if you go to the Life After Exoneration Program website or even our website, you can see that book, and it details causes of wrongful conviction. But let me talk about some of them. The leading cause of wrongful conviction of the innocent is mistaken eyewitness identification. In over 80% of these cases, eyewitness mis-ID played some substantial part in the wrongful conviction. And Jennifer Thompson talks about that in the film, as do other people. But again, most of the time, it's not that that witness is purposely trying to get the individual in prison for something he didn't do, though, you know, there is a small set of cases where that was the circumstance. But it's just that, you know, memory is fallible. And what the image is that was in that rape victim or that person's mind, and then they go back and they talk to the police and they try to make a sketch of what was in their mind, and then they see a lineup, and maybe the lineup has suggestion. What they eventually do is that they're trying to get the person that's in front of them, whether it's a picture or a lineup, the closest match to the drawing that was done. And this evolves over time, and it's a process that they don't realize they're doing it, but in the end, it's the wrong person. I mean, in Dennis's case in Massachusetts, to show you how strong misidentification can be, he was mis-ID'd by three separate women in three separate crimes. That also leads you to say, to assume, rather, or even a stronger word than assume, it leads you to really understand and believe that police misconduct, which is another cause of wrongful conviction of the innocent, played a part in that. It's very difficult to believe that three independent witnesses were able to identify someone incorrectly. In studying these cases, there's really a good foundation to believe and to know that the police, there was suggestiveness in the procedures that led to that identification. In fact, when Dennis was originally picked up, one of the victims said it was not him, and he left the courtroom. There was three different rape cases, that's why I'm saying three. He was eventually convicted on three different counts, and he left the courtroom. And on his way out, they actually arrested him for a different crime, one of these other rapes, and had another victim outside say it was him. I mean, without getting into a lot of details, these cases sometimes are that crazy. So far I've touched on misidentification, prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct. Another leading reason is junk science. Either purposeful or accidental forensic scientists that would get up on the stand and say that the serology matched him. You know, before DNA testing, they used blood typing to say that only a certain subset of the population has, you know, type O blood, and their secretors where that's in the semen. And they could say, well, Herman Atkins is only 5% of the population that semen could have come from. Well, that's junk science. Not only did it not match Herman's blood type, but if it did match Herman's blood type, it would have been a far greater percentage of the population that it could have matched, over 30%. There is also a concern in today's world where DNA is available, that junk science can still lead to the wrongful conviction of individuals. If the crime labs are not conducting the tests in a proper fashion, if there's not the proper controls, we have to make sure that the labs, that these are safe testing conditions and reliable test conditions. So junk science would be another reason. And it's early in the morning, so I got to think about a few others. We'll jump around to something else and I'll come back. But eyewitness mis-ID, junk science, prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct. These are some of the major causes of wrongful conviction.
We only have a few minutes left. When you started this project, you obviously had some expectations and some views of what would come out of it. Did those change over the course of producing this film?
In terms of what would come, what the life of the film would be and what the impact would be?
Yeah, and just what you, how you perceived the criminal justice system. Were things, did things appear worse after producing the film?
See, for me, I mean, I really lived with it as a student for 2 years, 1 year as an Innocence Project student, and the next year as a criminal law student. So I had a really fair understanding of the difficulties that are involved in the system. So, for example, when people are horrified by the Wilton Dedge case, where prosecutors fought for 3 years just for him, this is one thing I haven't emphasized, that the prosecutors fight to just have the testing done. They're afraid to see the truth. They're afraid to acknowledge their mistakes. Actually, and that's another issue that, well, so the point is that when people see this film, I mean, when people involved in the filmmaking, they were shocked. Well, why would the prosecutors fight to get the testing done? Let's see if we have an innocent person in prison, which, by the way, if we have someone innocent in prison, that means the actual perpetrator is still out there with the possibility of committing crime. So this is not just about exonerating the innocent. This is about justice. This is about getting the actual perpetrator. So I was not shocked during the filmmaking process when I watched prosecutors vehemently prevent an innocent man from getting out of prison and acknowledging the truth. Others were. So my sense of the justice system has not changed. It just has, you know, invigorated my desire to get this issue out there and to, you know, have the country understand that the exonerated need assistance. It's our moral obligation to help them, and it's also our obligation to reform the criminal justice system. The reason that the exonerees are so important is it's for the first time we understand the causes of wrongful conviction, and now we can go back and we have reforms on eyewitness identification, junk science. We put procedures in place that prevent or reduce the occurrence of prosecutorial misconduct. And what this will mean is we'll have a more just system moving forward. And this is, you know, also very important to the whole movement. So again, I just want to say that the website is afterinnocence.com. The film is playing in Seattle at the Varsity Theater, which is one of the landmark theater chains. The phone number for that theater is 206-781-5755. Again, 206-781-5755. And if people go to afterinnocence.com, they can see where the film's playing across the country.
All right. Well, I know you got a plane to catch, so yeah. I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Just been talking with Mark Simon. He is producer and writer of the new film After Innocence. And again, you can go to their website, afterinnocence.com. Check it out at the Varsity Theater, playing this weekend and through next week.